This is an ABC podcast.
Not good. I could probably use some other words, but yep, it's real poor. There's just no one around. Our members have been advertising for months and months, and there's just no skilled operators around.
Australia's cropping regions are on course for a big harvest, but like so many sectors of the economy at the moment, could a lack of workers derail the bumper season? And Australia's had its best swimming campaign at an Olympics ever, so will this inspire a new generation with eyes on Brisbane 2032?
I have been swimming since I was about 6 years old, and I started it because my brother loves swimming. It's super exciting that we're going to have a home Olympics. And definitely does make you want to, you know, get out there and train harder.
I'm Alex Simon and this is Australia Wide. We start tonight in northern Tasmania. It's not your usual breakfast buffet, but on a rainy morning in Launceston, bacon, eggs and COVID vaccines are on offer at the Salvation Army. The push is on for Tasmanians to get vaccinated. And a team from a government-funded medical group have been travelling the state to ensure no one is left behind. For those with low literacy or insecure housing, accessing a COVID vaccine can have extra challenges. Challenges this team are intent on removing. Pia Wursu has the story.
When Lance Christensen found out there was a mobile clinic delivering vaccines, he couldn't wait to roll his sleeve up.
Me and my son often come down here and have the beautiful food. And then one of the felicitators has said that they were having COVID shots, and I put my hand straight up. So I had my first shot 4 or 5 weeks ago, I think, and I actually couldn't wait for today.
The clinics have delivered more than 600 vaccines around the state to some of Tasmania's most vulnerable. Dr. Megan McEwen is Medical Director of Moreton Group Medical Services.
Aim of our program is to reach a population that are living without a permanent home. And when that happens to you, it brings quite a lot of difficulties with access to normal services. So instead of making people come to the COVID vaccination centres, we're bringing a COVID vaccination centre to them. And it's really the only way to break down those barriers.
Mr. Christensen says having the clinic come to someone's local is a huge help.
It makes it a whole lot easier, especially for people on the fringes, for them to be able to just come here without having to book appointments, especially if someone's in a wheelchair. They're not going to be able to get to a doctor's surgery if they can just come to their local. And so I think it's fantastic.
With Australian Bureau of Statistics figures showing almost half the Tasmanian population struggle to read and write, it's also a chance to help people understand complex information and consent forms, something Dr. McEwen says is an issue.
Along with literacy barriers, there's health literacy barriers. So a lot of information that people are carrying comes from word of mouth and social media.
Rosalie Martin, literacy advocate and speech pathologist, wants to see more done to ensure COVID communications are accessible to all Tasmanians, regardless of their level of literacy.
We are at risk of many people in the population not having all the information that they need in order to be able to conduct themselves in accordance with the public health recommendations. The brochures that are handed out are still very large on written language and quite small on icons. So using images is really key, and making sure that those images are clear and that the written language alongside of them is written in plain English.
Getting the vaccine message through is also a challenge for migrant communities. John Ali, community liaison for the Migrant Resource Centre North, is frustrated organisations like his aren't able to access the information they need.
You have many people who even don't read and write their own language. You don't expect them to just learn English in a very short time and understand it. I would urge that the government actually engage with organizations that are already working with these people to be able to provide face-to-face information sessions.
Health Minister Jeremy Rockcliffe says the government uses a variety of strategies to reach people with low literacy or from non-English speaking backgrounds.
That's Northern Tasmania reporter Pia Wursu reporting there.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. Great to have your company. I'm in for Sinead Mangan. Many of Australia's cropping regions are gearing up for another big harvest. Rain and high commodity prices are expected to lead to a record area sown this winter. But with international borders still closed, there may not be enough workers to get the crop off the ground. Central West New South Wales reporter Hugh Hogan has this story.
Sort of can't go wrong really anywhere north of Parksville. Around there is really good. Sort of around the Forbes area where we do a lot of work, it's probably starting to get a little bit too wet, if anything.
Pat Dwyer is a farmer and contractor from north of Parks in the central west of New South Wales. His spray rig has been parked for weeks with paddocks too wet to get onto, and he's flat out trying to keep up with the workload.
Yeah, we'd definitely look at expanding our business if the people were there. Like, there's more work than you can poke a stick at, really, for us. And, you know, we're busy and busy each year, but we've sort of pulled the reins back on everything we do just because, you know, the workers aren't there, really.
Over the last 18 months, thousands of international workers have left Australia and very few have returned because of the ongoing COVID restrictions on international arrivals.
Normally there would be a lot of backpackers come over, and I think it's a big issue. Like I say, it's not a massive issue for us, but some bigger operations, it's definitely a big issue.
And it doesn't get much bigger than GrainCorp.
Like last year, we're shaping up for another big crop across East Coast Australia. It is back to a traditional winter. It's cold and wet. And goodness, as we come out into spring, as it warms up, it's going to explode.
For operations manager Nigel Lotz, an explosion in crops means he needs to find around 3,000 casuals to run the largest network of grain bunkers on the East Coast.
To date, we've been open for basically a week now. We've already had, I think it's nearly 1,000 applicants, which is terrific. But we're always conscious that there is a big demand pull in agribusiness at the moment. All the way through the supply chain, people are after people to come on board.
With the usual backpackers not available, GrainCorp's targeting people finishing Year 12 or university who are looking for a different experience.
There's challenging on pay. There's a lot of people targeting people, and I think pay rates are going up. There's a lot of infrastructure projects across the country as well. You've got inland rail starting to kick up. So there's a lot of demand on these regional rural workforce. Look, one way or another, we will achieve a good harvest receival and a good customer service delivery for the growers, but it will be a challenge.
Not good. I could probably use some other words, but yep, it's real poor. There's just no one around.
Rod Gribble is the president of the Australian Custom Harvesters Association.
Our members have been advertising for months and months, and there's just no skilled operators around.
He's worried any delays from a lack of workers could spell disaster come harvest time.
If those crops don't get harvested at the right time and they have a major weather event, that's mega, mega millions of dollars lost. Mega millions. Now that runs all the way through from contractors to farmers to the community to the wider Australian economy. We're not talking a couple of million, we're talking multitudes of millions.
He's calling for fully vaccinated skilled workers to be allowed into the country and to do their mandatory quarantine on farms.
You know, we have people that have been here before. They want to come again. You know, we're talking maybe 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000. That's all. We can't see why, if these people are fully vaccinated, have a negative COVID test and isolate out on farm, because quite frankly, their greatest risk is isolating in a city hotel.
And according to Mr. Gribble, pay isn't an issue.
If there's no skilled ones here, you can pay them $500 an hour. It's not going to make any bloody difference. You need skilled workers. You know, a lot of these people, they get paid more than $30 an hour. They're punching over $2,000 to $3,000 a week. You know, I wouldn't mind getting paid that much.
And he says you can't just chuck anyone into a header and expect them to be able to do the job.
A modern header is $800,000 plus. Okay, they've got a lot of technology on them. They're certainly not idiot-proof, but you need someone who knows what they're doing, who's got a basic idea about the harvester and the harvesting operation. You know, it's fanciful to believe that you can train someone on some sort of two-day-a-week tech course and be able to have a skilled operator out the other end. It's just not going to happen.
Back in the Central West, Pat Dwyer agrees.
You're sort of up around $600,000 there for a machine like that, and you sort of can't just have anyone in it because it starts costing big dollars when things go wrong, you know, and you sort of got to have experienced blokes doing that. And not only that, with chemical and things like that, with a boom spray, you know, you sort of just can't put in whatever and hope for the best.
And he says a lot of people are starting to worry about the upcoming harvest.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real issue. You only see lately a lot of people are already advertising, looking for harvest workers. You know, I've even heard of blokes selling machines because they just physically haven't got blokes to sit in them. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a big snowball effect. And, you know, coming off a couple of hard years and having a good year last year, and we sort of need another one to back everything up this year, you know, everyone's going to be pretty well under the pump to get the harvest off to make the most of it.
I'd just like federal and state governments to realise how serious this situation is, and they must act very soon.
That's Rod Gribble from the Australian Custom Harvesters Association, ending that story by Hugh Hogan in Orange. You also heard from contractor Pat Dwyer and GrainCorp's Nigel Lotz.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
To the WA goldfields now. Western Australia was behind other states on its container deposit scheme, designed to promote recycling through monetary incentives for collecting and returning your plastics in containers. Now the scheme is significantly affecting recycling behaviour, and many areas of regional Australia that have never had any recycling services are outperforming the Perth metro area. Kalgoorlie reporter Elsa Silberstein has the story.
The container deposit scheme is having a significant impact on recycling behaviour across regional WA. The amount of recycling waste being collected by the city of Kalgoorlie-Boulder has decreased remarkably in the last year. Here's waste management team leader from the city of Kalgoorlie-Boulder, Dylan Martini.
So from our collections, we've seen a decrease in 23% of volume of recycling.
The fall has been attributed to the introduction of WA's container deposit scheme in October last year.
Recycling has instead gone directly through the container deposit scheme.
It followed South Australia, which has had a container deposit scheme for more than 40 years, the Northern Territory, New South Wales and Queensland. WA's one is called Containers for Change, and it reimburses people with 10 cents for every container they collect. Containers for Change CEO Tim Cusack says the uptake in the goldfields has been immense.
The goldfields community has so far, up till the end of June, returned 17 million containers to the scheme. Our numbers would suggest that is about 6 in 10 that is sold into the market.
He says the goldfields are a part of a larger trend across regional WA, keenly participating in the scheme.
Regional WA, generally, including the Goldfields Esperance, is outperforming metropolitan Perth. And that's partly because a lot of those communities have never had recycling bins, a household yellow lid bin. So recycling or household recycling really wasn't a thing in many communities in regional WA. But all that changed permanently on the 1st of October, where for the first time communities could recycle certainly all their drink containers.
Mr. Cusack says a big contributor to plastic waste in the region are mining companies, with 4 in 10 containers of the total market still ending up in landfill.
And we know a lot of that is really across the mining sector, and we're looking for mining companies in the mining sector to get involved with the scheme. There are many community groups already benefiting through partnerships with mining companies, and we're looking for that to happen right across the state, because if we can get those containers out of landfill and all of that wonderful resource that can be reused, if we can capture that and get it back to the scheme, that avoids it going into landfill and all the environmental issues attached with that.
Recycling expert Dara Mayer is a senior sustainability consultant at Right Solutions. He says he's noticed an increase in recycling behaviour over the years.
Purely just based around the amount of awareness that's out there, you know, around our impacts and the impact of wasteful behaviour.
Mr. Mayer has collaborated with mining company Nova to change over to a completely compostable mine site in the goldfields.
We've got a controlled camp. So a lot of the waste are the materials that come in and the materials that come out. It's a controlled space. So if we provide the education to the people that are on site, we can actually get some really, really good results.
Mr. Mayer says the key to changing recycling behaviour is to educate people about the impacts of where your waste is going.
I find a lot of people that maybe have visited parts of the world that have been impacted by plastic or pollution tend to be a lot more cautious or a lot more aware of what they do with their waste. a lot of times people just aren't exposed to the impacts. And I think especially being in Australia, you know, we live in such a beautiful place, and obviously for such a long period of time, a lot of our waste has been dealt with elsewhere. So we didn't really actually see the real impact. And because of that, we haven't bared any of those scars necessarily. We've been quite a throwaway society, and it's one of those things where it's chuck away and forget. You know, we don't actually think about, well, where does this end up?
That report from WA Goldfields reporter Elsa Silberstein.
ABC Australia Wide.
Look, Australia has the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. Let's turn back that tide of extinctions.
On ABC Radio.
And it's Alex Hyman here with you. Great to have your company. A primary school in North Queensland has transformed its bus stop into a drive-through fruit and veggie stall in an effort to feed more locals. Students at Seaforth State School near Mackay have been selling daily produce out of two big Eskies to ensure the wider community has access to affordable food. And it's been a massive hit. Teacher Mel Francis and Principal Troy Mutton explained to Mackay reporter Christy Lee McQueen how the project works.
So the Esky project is called the Fresh Food Farmers. Sue Rogers, our amazing teacher aide, has developed our garden in the school with the help, the assistance of the children. So when our produce is grown, Sue puts it into the Eskies at the front of the school for the community to come along and purchase products from the Eskies. And then also what happens is we kind of have a bit of a barter system too, where the community can bring in their own produce as well, and we can resell it, or they can kind of swap their veggies for veggies out of the Eskies. So yeah, it's a big thing for our community in that community engagement.
So we're just out the front of Seaforth State School on the footpath, underneath one of the shelters here in front of the bus stop. There's two big Eskies on the bench here. You got a blackboard behind, you know, $1 avos, tomatoes, oranges, eggs $3. How did this all start?
Where the veggie garden currently is, it actually used to be an old tennis court. So that was there for quite a while, and then they ripped the old tennis court up, and we as a staff talked about what we wanted that to become. And we always wanted a veggie garden in our school because we thought, you know, that's a great learning opportunity for our students to be able to plant, grow, use that produce to do cooking within the school. We could use it in the tuck shop. And then Sue thought of the great idea to be able to, because we had so much produce, what to do with it. We didn't want to, you know, have to let it go rotten or anything like that. So she went, well, why don't we sell it to the community? You know, we've got a lot of retirees out this way. Fruit and veggies can be quite expensive in town. It's quite a drive to town. So we started selling it to the community, and it's just gone absolutely crazy. So the money that we make from selling our produce goes straight back into the garden. We have teacher aides and teachers who do come in the holidays who they make lemon butter. So they've been making lemon butter, tomato relish. So that's using our own produce to make jams and things to sell to the community again.
That's sort of full circle, where people are using the produce from the Eskies and the garden here, making condiments or relish and bringing it back.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fantastic. Like, I know on the Seaforth community page, you know, there's, Sue's always putting things up there, letting the community know what's available in the Esky. And people are always on there going, you know, I've got avocados, or I've got some spare bush lemons. Would you like that? Or would you like some jars? And the community support has been absolutely phenomenal.
And how does the money system work?
Yeah, so it is kind of an honesty box system. So we do trust the community, I guess, to do the right thing. But, you know, we're pretty easygoing. So I think there's a couple of IOUs in there. And as Mel said before, kind of have a bit of a barter system as well. So you might take out a piece of pumpkin and you might put in a couple of avocados. So, yeah, it's kind of works on an honesty system. We don't want it to get too complicated, but so far it's all been going really, really well. So
what's the feedback been like from people who, you know, this has been a huge help for?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. The community absolutely loves it. You know, they talk very positively about what we're doing. They can see that it's great for the kids to be able to understand about, you know, growing fresh produce and how to look after it. And the kids just absolutely love it. And I think it's really good for them to understand that not food doesn't just come from a shop. It actually can be grown and we can eat it straight. Like, they pick strawberries straight from the garden and eat them, and they take passion fruit home and have it with ice cream at night, and they come back the next day and they rave about it. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Let's go have a look, shall we?
Yes, let's do it.
So we've walked into just behind the Eskies to this beautiful garden now. How quickly has this grown since the Esky project's taken off too, Troy?
Well, pretty well everything you see in front of us here has probably come to fruition in the last 18 months. It started with kind of one garden bed, and we would get a little bit of extra money, so we'd buy a few extra slabs of timber. And as you can see here, I think we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pretty established garden plots, and we've got another 3 on the way by the look of it. There's some strawberries that the kids have planted earlier this term, tomatoes, there's heaps of passion fruit vines growing, chives, orange and lemon trees, as you can see behind us. There's just so much in here, it's not funny.
So what's the vision, Mel, for this garden and the Esky project?
Really keen on getting the older generation of the community into the school to be, you know, come in and do cooking with the children and do art and craft activities with the children. So, being able to build that bond between the elder generation and the younger generation within our community.
And no matter how big this whole project gets, do you think it'll still remain 2 Eskies out the front?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And everyone does, put in. We all help each other because, we've got to change over the ice bottles in the Esky every morning and every afternoon. So, when we go out and do bus duty, we take the ice bricks out and we put new ones in and, we swap over produce and things like that.
Have you heard of anything to this sort of level happening at any other primary schools around the country? I mean, just even with the Esky front, it sort of seems pretty unique.
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely unique. Like, I don't think Sue, that was ever, in her vision, but it kind of just happened. We had all this produce and she said, what are we going to do with it? And that was her fantastic idea, and we painted the chalk paint on the school shelter there and we used chalk to write on it and it just went crazy.
And I think we're quite lucky with just where the school is situated. I think that's kind of also helped as well, because we've got this beautiful little laneway that runs up beside our school. So community members don't need to actually come into the school to purchase these goods. They can just pull into the laneway, grab what they need out of the Esky and then be on their way. So it's really quick, it's really easy. And lots of schools have different gardens, but I don't know probably to this extent, I suppose.
That's Troy Mutton and Mel Francis from Seaforth State School in North Queensland, speaking with ABC Mackay reporter Christy Lee McQueen. And finally tonight, let's finish with some of Australia's Olympic glory. Yesterday, Australia wrapped up its most successful swimming campaign ever at an Olympics, with the likes of the Campbell sisters, Emma McKeon and Kaylee McEwen, moving Australia right up the medal tally. So with around 10 years out from the Brisbane Olympics, what impact do swimmers like the Sunshine Coast Kaylee McEwen have on the next generation of young swimmers, especially those in regional areas? Reporter Jake Kiernan went poolside to find out.
My name is Georgia Edwards and I am 12. I have been swimming since I was about 6 years old, and I started it because my brother loves swimming. It's super exciting that we're going to have a home Olympics, and definitely does make you want to, get out there and train harder.
We've also got a local girl competing over in Tokyo, Kaylee McEwen. What sort of inspiration has she been for you as a swimmer?
I think just all the problems that she's gone through, with her dad and everything that an athlete faces, and for her to keep striving, it's just real inspiration for when I go through problems to just keep going, as an athlete and in life as well.
I believe Kaylee's 20 years old, you're 12, so in 8 years time, let's just say that could potentially be you. Do you think you could try and push for a spot in the 2032 Olympics team?
Oh, who knows, we'll see how it goes.
Henry Thatcher and I'm 11.
Now Henry, what's your best stroke?
Probably backstroke or freestyle.
What's your favourite stroke?
Backstroke.
So you're a bit of a backstroker, just like Kaylee McEwen, who just won gold over in Tokyo.
Yeah.
What did it mean to sort of sit there and watch her win gold the other day?
It's good to watch Australians win gold.
Does that motivate you to want to go and achieve big things in swimming?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, I might have a quick chat to your mum. This is Thatcher. Henry's here swimming. We've got the Olympics on at the moment. Yeah, it's pretty exciting for these young fellas to see a local girl doing well over the Olympics.
Yeah, it's been really good, and it's been really nice for them to sort of be able to watch people that sort of come from their area, and they can see that maybe, if they work hard, they could get to that level potentially someday as well. So, no, it's been nice to be able to watch them and get inspired.
I guess for a lot of these youngins, it's probably their first Olympics. Do you think anyone at this training here could potentially end up at 2032?
I would have to say definitely my niece, Holly Page, who's swimming in the pool now. She is an absolutely excellent swimmer, and I reckon she'd be one potentially to look out for in 2032.
Holly Page, a name to watch. That's Shona Thatcher speaking there with Sunshine Coast reporter Jake Kiernan. And that's Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll join you again tomorrow. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.